Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. Gold was doing well until this week. Ross also tells us why you're paying way too much for coffee. Publisher of the realestatetiming.com newsletter, Robert Campbell, tells us people are fleeing California to avoid sky-high taxes. Market historian Bob Hoy notes since the Fed was invented, there have been at least 18 recessions, and it's going to drive the U.S. economy into recession once again. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from Recyclico CEO Zarko Maselja. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Ross, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Good to be with you, Jim. And so we go from weeks and weeks of chatter to pretty exciting closing off to this week.
So what happened on the stock markets in the past week?
Well, let's just say we're into the heart of the earnings season here. The big names, the Amazon, the Netflixes, the Apple. So you've got those earnings out and getting some pretty big action. And normally you got things like Ford down 7% because they're missing on their numbers. But right at the end of the week, we got this jobs number in the States, 517,000 new jobs as far as the employment was concerned. Now, you know, when they delve into that number after the initial reaction, they realize that it's really not as good as it looked. There's a lot of seasonality and other things built into it. But it sure did have an impact in terms of the market, the dollar index, the commodities. And so, here we are. We've been looking at the dollar index sort of grinding its way down, making marginally lower lows, had a little bit of a bounce 2 weeks ago, but couldn't get any life in it. And then now, as of this week, we finally got an outside reversal week in that we had a lower, probably the lowest low that we've seen in the better part of the year, and then closed higher on the week, not only just up, but higher than the previous week. So pretty good outside reversal as far as the dollar index is concerned. And if you look at the euro dollar, you see the same type of action inverse to that. And if you look at the Canadian dollar versus the U.S., another reversal on that one. Not as bad, definitely... down about a half a cent here on the Canadian dollar. It's still got some pretty heavy overhead resistance, both in terms of price levels and in terms of the moving averages. So I think the Canadian dollar, while it got a little bit of help from the agricultural commodities a few weeks ago, it's kind of running out of steam right now.
What's happening with crude?
Poor close off to the week here. Once again, another one of these commodities that had been trying to have a little bit of a bounce here. We had been up and testing decent resistance in the low 80s, 82 level. Got some short-term sell signals up there a week ago with the sequential. We got a sequential 9. Means that we'd had 9 consecutive days of good upside price action, and we were ready for a reversal. And so by the time it finished off this week, we're right back down testing of those of last year. And at this point, seasonality would suggest that we probably have a little bit more pressure in this one before it has a chance to come to life. Going to need to see a close, I would say, really through that $82 level to say that there's any change in direction at this point to the upside.
What's happening with gold?
Gold, a huge reversal week. You know, here we got a $100 range this week. New high for the move on the year. That's pretty easy to say. It's only been around for a month. But it was doing very, very well until 2 days ago. We put in a new high up in the 1970 range. But the money flow oscillators were not confirming the move. And we had had some upside adjustment readings in the 10 days before that. And typically at interim highs in gold, you'll see an upside exhaustion, and then you'll have an attempt to make a new high. In this case, we did make a marginally higher high, but you don't have the follow-through as far as the volumes are concerned. And so that lack of buying means that there's any sign of weakness at all, and the selling pressure will kick in. Now, it ended up, as you say, $100 week, closed at 1876 on the active futures contract. And at this point, it would typically go down and hit the 50-day moving average, which is where we are getting pretty close to that very soon here, probably around the 1855 level we'll be looking for. And we'll have, we've got an update as far as the report is concerned on gold that we'll be punching out to subscribers this weekend. But this has been sort of a classic high as far as this gold market is concerned. And the reversal, we'll have some guidelines to say pushing forward.
Now, you'd think if the price of some commodity dropped dramatically, you'd get a price break at the store. But if you're a coffee fan like me, I'm paying more at Starbucks, but should they be charging me more?
I don't think it's fair. I mean, here we are. This coffee was up at 260, you know, 6-8 months ago. Drops down to 145 to 150. So dramatic decline. I didn't see any price declines when I was looking around the stores recently. And now we've had a little bit of a bounce up to 171. And my, oh my, there's, we won't mention the names, but one of those big, distributors of coffee on all those corner stores, has, decided that it's time to bump the price up. So it's not because of the price of coffee. It must be something else. So maybe a little, greed is out there right now. So, it's been a pretty decent run off the bottom percentage wise. If anything, I would say it's probably a little bit ahead of itself, but that's not going to help you much as far as the store shelves are concerned.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at Charts by Ross. Coming up, Robert Campbell next on This Week in Money.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Robert Campbell, publisher of the realestatetiming.com newsletter. He's speaking to us from beautiful San Diego. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim. We're having a heat wave here relative to the rest of the country. It's in the high 50s.
Or that would be 10, 12 degrees in Celsius.
Whatever. Boston's below zero. That's all I know. I'm not going to live there.
Bob, when's the next Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter going to be published?
It's coming. It will come out. I just published one in January 15th, and the next one will be March 15th. I publish it every 2 months.
Would your book, Timing the Real Estate Market, be an important read for 2023?
I'm biased, but it's an important read all the time. If whether you're a homeowner buying and selling a house, or you're an investor buying and selling, knowing when to buy and is the best time to buy and sell real estate, it's all about timing, everybody. I mean, you want to, you know, here's how you make millions in real estate. You buy when prices are low, and you sell when prices are high. I mean, that's how you make money. That's how you develop some real, you know, real wealth without assuming a lot of risk. And so that's why I say I use timing in everything. Timing's everything. It's everything you do in life, you know, including, you know, how you when and how you invest.
The rate of inflation is decreasing, supposedly. Historically, does inflation hit in waves?
Yes, it does. I mean, if you go back to the 70s, you know, the 70s in the U.S. and back during World War II, and if you look at the wave pattern for inflation, you know, it has an initial wave, then it backs off, then it has a second wave, and it goes higher than the first wave, then backs off, but it doesn't back off as low as the first wave, then it has the final thrust up, which is the third wave, and then the inflation is over, and it settles down to something that's more reasonable.
Now, something, at least here in Canada, Hilliard Macbeth, friend of the show, pointed out that mortgage payments are not included in the price of living index. So even though higher interest rates are forcing you to pay, some people are paying $3,000 more a month, the government officially doesn't recognize that you have to pay more. So in other words, these higher interest rates are actually contributing to inflation. They're not helping stop it.
That's correct.
Yeah. So the Fed raised rates by another 25 basis points. Could interest rates increase in waves, or they finished now?
Yes, the rate of inflation is in fact decreasing. I mean, but relative to its wave-like pattern in the past, does that mean that the risk of higher inflation no longer exists? No, it doesn't. In fact, here in the United States, one of the things, the government passed this omnibus package, which is like $1.7 trillion worth of U.S. deficit spending. It's not going to get covered by taxes, so it's deficit spending. So, and I think that's going to go in effect this year or so, you know, when they're going to start spending all this money. The only way that they're going to get that money is by floating more debt. And so that the U.S. government has money to pay for these services and these new things. Well, you know damn well that $1.7 worth of money spent isn't going to be well spent. It's going to be sloppily spent. So now you have that input there. You got all that money entering the system with half the production that you should normally get out of it, that's going to be inflationary. So I continue to believe that this inflationary episode is far from over.
How accurate is the CPI, the Consumer Price Index?
It's not accurate at all. It's about 3 or 4% higher than they actually say it is. And get this, starting in January, the Bureau of Labor Statistics is rejiggering the inflation formula, you know, to make it lower. Because every time the government rejiggers the inflation numbers, the readings get lower and lower and lower, not higher. And one of the reasons why they do this is so many of the government benefits, especially Social Security, are tied to cost of living indexes, which is inflation, COLA. And they want to understate the COLA as much as they can to stay solvent. So there you are. So, you know, Social Security benefits, so they'll rejigger it. So I don't know what inflation is now, between 6 and 7. Then after they're done rejiggering it, then it'll be like at least 1 percentage point lower. So next year when everybody gets their Social Security benefits, it'll be 1% lower. And that adds up to a lot of money. But who gets screwed? The people on Social Security, of course. Like, I know, duh.
Now, on the show, Martin Armstrong said that inflation in food, energy, and transportation is actually running at up to 32% annually. With higher interest rates and high real inflation, are people still able to afford mortgages to buy homes?
Absolutely. And I believe what Armstrong is saying. With respect to mortgages, if you look at mortgages, something like, it's come down a little because the mortgage rates have come down a little and home prices have come down a little. But compared to a year ago, like the average mortgage payment At today's interest rate, at the average price home, is still like 50% higher than it was a year ago. That's a huge increase. Huge. And they say that's not inflation. Of course it's inflation.
In 2022, the U.S. dollar was at its highest level since 2002. What are your thoughts on the greenback?
Well, I think that, you know, the dollar's a hard call. But the dollar has had, since the Fed started raising interest rates back in September of 22, the U.S. dollar's gone down, and of course gold has gone up because they're well correlated. But now everybody seems to think that, you know, the Fed's backing off. This was a quarter point. Next one's going to be zero. So the higher interest rates go, you know, the higher the dollar goes. The lower interest rates go, the lower the dollar goes. So now that recently the dollar has attracted some new strength that it didn't have a month or two ago. So it all depends what the Fed does. You know, it all depends on whether they think that, you know, this is a lot worse than people think, and we've got to start stimulating the economy. We need to start using QE and get, you know, mortgage rates back down to 3% or lower. It all depends on what they do, because that's the straw that stirs the drink.
Are you bullish on the stock market for the first half of the year?
Yeah, I am. I mean, look at the trend. All you got to do is look at the trend. I mean, in fact, that recently in the past, you know, month, it's all risk is back on in the markets. You know, gold's going up. I mean, stock market's going up. Bonds are going up. You know, even though that's a risk off, they're going up. Gold's going up along with the stock market. And those type of things. So it's, hell, even Bitcoin's going up. It went from 16,000 to 23. And listen to this. Tesla stock. Tell you how crazy the market is right now. Jan 1, 2023, Tesla was $100, more or less. 30 days later, it's $200. That is a 100% rise in 30 days. How much of that do you want in your portfolio? I mean, that's crazy. So risk is definitely back on.
What's the latest on sale prices and volumes for the U.S. housing markets, and especially California with all the recent flooding?
Well, that remains to be seen. What that's going to do to the housing market. The U.S. housing market is in a clear downtrend. And a lot of people think that lower interest rates are going to save it. You're starting to say, oh, my, we've had our correction. You know, real estate went sideways for a year or something like that. Now it's ready to start its next leg up. I think that's complete BS. Because if you look at the last two downturns in the United States, you know, from 1990 to 1996, from 2006 to 2012, mortgage rates declined between 2 percentage points and 3 percentage points, no, approximately 3 percentage points during each of those declines. And it didn't stop the decline in home prices. So everybody's focused on interest rates, but once the mood of the market changes, especially at these high levels with this high affordability, it's going to take a long time for that to bleed off before the housing market can gain new strength. And that's going to be at lower prices.
Are there different real estate trends in Republican states versus Democrat states?
Well, I live in a red state. I mean, I live in a blue state, right? California. And I'll tell you that we have the weakest housing market in the country right now. And in fact, you know, the Bay Area housing market is the weakest housing market, you know, in the country, major housing market. I think there's some spots up in Idaho and things like that. Everything got way, way overpriced, even more than California. But that it's we're hurting the worst in the country right now. So we're a blue state, and you know, and that's that. What the historical on that is, I have no idea.
What does it mean in real estate when the price is set at the margin?
What that means is this: let's say you live on a block. Let's say on your street, there's 10 homes, and they're all $1 million. Okay. Now, based on last comps, it's $1 million. All of a sudden, one of those homeowners has to sell for one reason. They want to sell. They lost their job. Any number of reasons. They want to sell to move out of state. And whatever the new, whatever the price of that house sells for, even though no comps had ever come in less than $1 million in the last 6 months, maybe he has to lower his price to $800,000 to find a buyer. Now, every one of those homes on that street, in that neighborhood, is no longer worth $1 million. It's worth $800,000 because that's the last comp. And that's what it called, and that's what is meant by the price is set at the margin. It's the last sale that dictates.
Death rates are up substantially. Could this affect home inventories and sales?
Well, sure. I mean, the inventory. In fact, the only thing that's keeping the housing market from declining even faster is inventory is still low. There's a lot of people out there that would like to sell, but they can't get their old price that they could have got, you know, back in May or June of 2022 when housing prices peaked. And they say, oh, I'm not going to give my house away. You know, I'm just going to hang on to it for now, and we'll put it back on the market, you know, in 6 months, a year, or, you know, when we can get our old price. And that's the mentality.
Are we likely to see a buying time for real estate this year?
No. No, we will not see a buying time. The buying time for real estate is going to be about 2028, 2029, based on real estate cycles that I follow very closely.
Do you think wealth taxes are a possibility, and would they make money flee the U.S.?
Yeah, that Elizabeth Warren is introducing that idea, and it's supposedly supposed to start getting traction, if not turn into a bill in 2024. So especially in states like California that has super high expenses because of all their, you know, social programs, socialist giveaway programs, now they're going to start, you know, putting a wealth tax on people that have money. Now, I don't know where they're setting the limit on this initially, whether you have to be worth like $50 million or $200 million or whether you just have to be worth $1 million. All of a sudden, they're going to put a tax, and most likely, it'll be on your real estate, because that's where the big money is, and you're going to get taxed every year so that they can cover their increased social program, you know, especially with all the migrants coming in, you know, that we need to give them housing and send them to college and feed them and all that kind of stuff. That's expensive, and the state of California needs more money. And even if you leave the state, I have friends that are leaving the state. They go, I'm not going to put up with this crap. I'm moving. Now, they'll even track you out of state. A friend of mine is selling a $2 million home here in San Diego, and he's buying a similar home in Tennessee for $700,000, almost one-third the price. According to what I'm reading, California would still come after that guy, you know, and say, you owe us more money. You owe us more money. You made that $2 million and, you know, because you live in California. You owe us. So this can really get crazy and aggressive, where people, I don't know what people are going to do. They're just going to, you know, the government just wants to take your money. They want to take from the rich and give to the poor.
Are there psychological and work ethic reasons for the falling of productivity?
Yeah, I think much of it had to do with the fact that housing prices went up so high, so fast. You know, people that have jobs now, you know, now, entry-level jobs, they know that there's no way in hell that they're ever going to buy a house. So are they really motivated to work hard and get ahead? No, they're not. You know, they're going through the motions. They'll do whatever it takes just to get by, to rent a house or cover their expenses somehow, make a car payment. But what they feel like is that the system is corrupt. This is a lot of the young people, and all they're doing, working at any price, whether it's minimum wage at 15 or some other job, let's say at 25, are they getting ahead? No, they're not getting ahead. And they just think that they're like, you know, slave labor for the rich.
Bob, I wouldn't work hard either. I think they've seen how their parents, when they hit 50, 55, were laid off by companies because they were, quote, making too much money. And so why have any loyalty to a company if you know you're just a number, and the second you start making money, they're just going to let you go?
Exactly, exactly correct. And inflation has gotten so out of control that I just read a statistic yesterday that 51% of all people making making $100,000 a year or more, or living month to month. I mean, that's because high rent, high housing prices, high food costs, high taxation. In other words, even people doing that, you're going to get discouraged. You could go, I can't get ahead. So what's the point?
Years ago, we thought debt couldn't continue to grow, and yet here we are. It's still expanding. In reality, is there anything stopping the growth of debt from just continuing higher and higher?
Yes, interest rates. Interest rates. We come to a point, all of a sudden, if we have to start paying, you know, the government, I think back 2 years ago, servicing the U.S. debt or something, whatever it was, like, you know, $23 trillion or something, it was like, you know, $300 billion a year. Well, now it's like $32 trillion. Interest rates are double, and it's like $750,000 a year. So it's more than, you know, it's went up by 2.5 times. Okay, the debt is going to keep going up. I mean, this omnibus bill, I guarantee you, that's another $2 trillion on the national debt right there. So the debt keeps going up, and all of a sudden, if interest rates keep going up, the only one way is that they're going to default on the debt, or they have to start taxing people more in order to service the debt. And people have a limit with respect to taxation. Taxation is a very, very sensitive issue. You start overtaxing people, you know, they will leave. In fact, my friend that's moving from California to Tennessee, he said his property taxes on his $2 million home are like $20,000 a year. When he buys that new home in Tennessee at $700, the annual property taxes at least start out at $1,900. That's a huge difference. You know, that's $23,000 a year, so $1,500 a month to live here in California versus live in Tennessee just to cover property taxes. So there comes a point when people they're forced to move out. You can't afford it here anymore. You know, living in California, pretty soon the annual household income, you know, you have to be making at least $250 a year, you know, in order to live. What percentage of all people do that? Small. And if people start leaving California, you know, the people that are getting hurt the worst are the rich people. And that's where most of your tax revenue is coming from. It's not coming from us, you know, the slobs at the bottom. It's coming from the rich cats at the top. And if they leave, it just makes the matter worse.
Could central bank digital currencies be the cryptos for the one world order surveillance society?
Well, everybody's talking about that. I don't understand crypto, so I really don't have an opinion on that.
Do you have some thoughts of wisdom and health tips for us to close out the show?
Yeah, always health tips, guys. And I haven't changed anything dramatically lately, but what I'm still doing is I'm still keeping the course as far as, you know, living a super, super healthy life. I'm doing sprints, I'm doing Navy SEAL type exercises and keeping in great, great shape. So it's, the dividends, guys, are huge. You gotta eat. I used to chug, people always used to ask me growing up, you know, whether I was 50, 55, 60, 65, whatever, they said, what's your secret? I said, I'll tell you my secret. I said, but I'm not gonna give it away for free. I'll tell you for $95 and it's guaranteed to work. So, you know, this is all, so they, you know, hypothetically hand me $95 and said, okay, what's the secret? You got to eat right, you got to eat less, and you got to work out. And that after I tell them that, their reaction is always the same. Is there a plan B? And no, there is no plan B. So if you want it, you want it. You got to have it. And I'll tell you, it's just an amazing experience, guys. You know, to get into, you look at health and fitness, and 20 years ago they were telling you to eat Cheerios and avoid bacon and eggs. And now it's just the opposite. And you look at the United States is the second of all major countries in the United States, in the world, the United States is the most obese country in the world. People, you gotta learn to eat right. 2016 or latest, U.S. is the fat, total population that's obese. In the U.S., it is 40%. Chile's 34. Mexico's 33. Here's Canada. What's Canada? Canada is 28. So, I mean, we're still, look, whether we're number one or number two, is that where you want to be? No. You want to be at the bottom of the list. Let me see what the Japan is super low. I don't even know if Japan's on here. Yeah, Japan's 4.2. In other words, the U.S. obesity rate is 10 times what it is in Japan. How's that for a comparison? And you know what? They live a long time, Jim. The U.S. longevity rate, at least for males, has dropped 2 or 3 years in the last 5 years. Japan, with technology and diet and that, they keep, and medical advances, they live longer. We're living shorter in the United States, which is bucking the global trend. I think it has to do with stress. I know it has to do with stress. Everybody's stressed out. That's why we have, like, you know, 100,000 deaths last year from opiate death. What's that stuff they're bringing across the border that's so deadly?
Fentanyl.
Yeah, that stuff's a killer. 100,000 people out there got killed by that.
Yeah, they're dying in droves here in British Columbia.
I mean, you know what? This isn't a good sign, guys. It's a terrible trend. People are depressed. They don't want to work anymore. They're getting fat, and they don't care. You know what? I don't know how many of you people have seen Animal House, but that's one of my favorite all-time movies. In fact, that's exactly the fraternity that I went to when I graduated from UCLA, with the SEs right next door. I mean, not quite that bad, but when Dean Wormer came up and told that one guy, he goes, "That's no way to live your life, guys."
Bob, how can people find out more about your book and newsletter?
You can go to realestatetiming.com and find out what I do. Read a little bit about my background. My background is I have a degree in economics from UCLA. Which was just the start. It took me 30 years to learn it, after really learn it. But I did go to college and enjoyed that a lot. You can buy my book, Real Time in the Real Estate Market, which is a really good read, or you can subscribe to my newsletter, which is the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter, which is $159 a year. And one of the things I pride myself in with my newsletter, I write about things, real estate letter, I write about things that no other newsletter writer writes about. That's my advantage in the marketplace, guys. And whether you're good at what you do, you're a good rocket scientist or a good doctor, you have to be better than your competition in order to really excel. And that was just introduced to me the other day, you know, by a couple of my subscribers. They go, "You write about stuff that nobody else writes about." It's relevant to everything. Nobody else just sees the market like you do. And of course, I back it all up with facts. So, you know, I'm really proud of what I do. And that's my retirement income right there. I'll keep doing that until the day I die. So that, you know, there's steady income. I have, you know, assets that I've invested well over the time. And I'm in great physical shape. I have a great wife. And, you know, all those things make for a perfect life. And the biggest reason, and the health, it all starts with health. If you don't feel strong and healthy and feel good about yourself health-wise, I don't think you can really excel in other parts of your life.
Bob, thank you so much again.
Thank you. Bye.
My guest has been Robert Campbell, publisher of the realestatetiming.com newsletter. He was speaking to us from San Diego. Coming up, Bob Hoy, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
My guest is market historian Bob Hoy. He's the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. He's speaking to us from Vancouver. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Yeah, Jim, here we are, and it's our Friday morning get-together that I always enjoy, and It's been an interesting week in the markets.
We always like to start off our show with listener questions, and our questions today come all the way from the Netherlands, from Willem Gruters, a longtime listener. His question for you, Bob. The Fed recently has raised rates by 0.25% to 4.5%. Is Mr. Hoy aware that Mr. Market has been signaling since, say, early to late November 2022 that the Fed is going to lower rates this year? Mr. Market has right now the same setup as in late 2019 before COVID's crash happened and the rates went lower. Conversely, Mr. Market did signal well in advance in mid-2014 and late 2021 that the Fed was going to raise rates in 2014 and 2022. It's just a matter of knowing what charts to look at, Bob.
Right. Okay, good one. yeah, the way I look at it is the T-bill rate, 3-month bill or the 6-month bill, is the market-traded rate of interest, and it trades all of the time, every instant, in huge volume, a very liquid item. And the Fed runs with its administered rate, lately called Fed funds. And everybody thinks that the Fed sets the level of interest rates, but when you're at the end of a big boom and party, short rates go up on their own. T-bill rate goes up, and the Fed follows with increasing now, as I say, it's called the Fed funds level. So here we are. You have kind of a paradox where the Fed is seen to be raising interest rates, and the rise in short rates has inverted the yield curve, where short rates are higher than long rates. And we've got the U.S. yield curve on charts back to the 1860s. And the rule is that every time the curve inverts, you get followed by a recession. And then there's an added to this one that if it inverts with some enthusiasm, it signals that the recession is going to be worse than otherwise. So we've got both. Inversion, and it really had some enthusiasm on it. So here's the paradox. The Fed is inverting the yield curve, and a yield inversion is always followed by a recession. You got to want to say, well, why is the Fed raising the Fed rate? And it's because the T-bill rate has been going up naturally. So it has to look in chart. And in 1929, the T-bill rate went up until June, and then it didn't go up anymore. It was going down a little. But nevertheless, the Fed raised their, then it was the discount rate, from 5 to 6% in August. And the New York Times explained it as that the Fed was tightening money to speculators in Wall Street and easing money for business in Main Street. Nice line. And, of course, the crash came in, and then the Fed began a long series of discount rate cuts at the end of October. So this is what we would expect in here. It's always difficult to call the rising trend in short rates. We're watching it. But when it reverses, the T-bill rate will come down, and maybe a month or so later, the Fed will then start a series of Fed cuts in their rates down, with T-bill rates eventually heading down to something like 0%. So the point of this is to explain that the Fed follows the market. It doesn't create the market. So,
Bob, it's interesting. So they've hiked interest rates, and mortgage payments have gone up $2,000, $3,000 a month for some people. Interestingly, Hilliard Macbeth, who's a real estate expert, points out that your mortgage payments are not included in the cost of living index. We know taxes aren't.
Taxes are not, yeah.
Yeah, so these interest rate hikes are actually inflationary. They're part of the problem.
Yep, they're part of the cost of living, yep.
Yeah, they're part of the inflationary problem.
Yeah, they are.
Now, we'd like to touch on some headlines that caught your attention. The first one is German economy unexpectedly shrinks. Well, I think a lot of people expected it to. Maybe the Germans didn't.
Well, that was the headline. Yeah. Probably surprised policymakers and the establishment. But yeah, I think the global economy is in a post-bubble contraction, and it hasn't quite hit the U.S. yet, but there are places like China and whatnot are quite weak. So, I figure that the recession, the key thing is the inversion of the yield curve. And it's interesting that the yield curve inverted at its most exciting at going into Christmas. And we looked at 1929, the yield curve inverted right into, late in the year. Then also at the 1873 bubble, inversion into late in the year. So we're staying with the rule. Curve is inverted. The U.S. is heading for a recession.
Bob, can you maybe explain what an inverted yield curve is?
Sure. That's when short rates like treasury bill rates or the one-year or two-year note gets higher than longer maturities. Now, in a normal yield curve, short-term rates are lower than long-term because long-term has got some risk in it. But in a inverted yield curve that occurs with a boom, the demand for money for speculation, I think, pushes the T-bill rate up. And then that, in turn, forces the Fed to raise its interest rates. In a bureaucratic ritual, like trying to look like it's in charge of things. It looks like Germany is in a recession. And it surprised some headline writers.
Friend of the show, Rick Ackerman, says there's another good indicator that the U.S., no matter what they say about its, whether it's in a recession or not, he has a friend who is in the shipping pallet business, another friend in the cardboard box business, and their orders are way down this year. So things aren't being packed up and they're not being shipped.
Yeah.
And I said, how do you explain?
Those are interesting numbers.
Right. And he said the reason the GDP went up in the U.S. is so many inventories were depleted. People had to order new product. That's the only reason it went up.
Yeah.
Banks are bracing for more consumers to fall behind on their loans.
Yeah. There's always the problem. You take on credit and loans and debt and whatever in a boom. And then when things start to slow down, and the old saying in the banking business is that in the good times, the bankers are giving out umbrellas, and in the bad times, when it rains, they call the umbrellas in. And that's a pretty good analog for it. So,
Bob, since the U.S. Fed was created, the creature from Jekyll Island, as they call it, how many recessions have there been?
Oh, yeah. There's been 18 cyclical recessions, and the one in 2020 was due to COVID and everybody shut everything down. So I wouldn't call that a cyclical recession. But here's the thing with the pitch behind the Federal Reserve is that the key people in Washington and New York in the early 1900s knew that a financial crisis preceded a recession. So they came up with this idea that with the Fed as lender of last resort, there wouldn't be any financial crisis and there wouldn't be any recessions. And it's still an appealing idea. But, as I say, 18 cyclical recessions since the Fed opened its doors for business in January 1914. And in any scientific research field, one failure is all it takes to condemn a theory. This thing is now out to 18 failures. And the whole system of central banking obviously is not self-critical. It just keeps going along on this bureaucratic ritual that that maybe this time it'll work.
Well, don't the people who work for central banks, is their salary not tax-free?
I don't know. Depends which central bank, but ages ago in the around 1974, I got introduced to the head of research at the Bank of Canada, and he gave me the whole drivel about, you know, managing the economy and that not. And then eventually this guy went on to the Bank for International Settlements, BIS, and he ended up being very high up in there before he retired. And eventually he became more practical in his theories that intervention of central banking just doesn't work. And yet they can't quit trying to make it work. It's like Marxists. They at some point, they'll get it right, and they know that it'll work. And at some point, the central bankers think they can get it right, and it'll work, and they're there and they're now. But it's all coming apart. And the central bankers recently have been losing money because they were all along a whole ton of bonds. And I think maybe if one looked around, you might find that maybe one or two central bankers even went to modern portfolio theory and bought some stocks with their reserve. And they're in trouble. They're learning that perhaps gold, after all, is the ideal reserve. And then there's been some headlines recently that some central banks are buying gold for the reserve and at a pace not seen in a decade. So somewhere they're doing the right thing, and whether they think it's because of inflation and they lost such a whack of money in the bond market, who knows, but maybe it's their last choice. But nonetheless, some central banks are buying gold, and that is the proper thing to do.
Canada and the UK sold off all of their gold reserves at bargain basement prices. Do you think we're going to regret that?
Oh, yeah. I remember at the time it was something about Canada wanted to get into a G20 group or something like that, and I think the powers that be said, yeah, sell the rest of your gold and then you'll be a proper player. So,
I mean, they melted down historic gold coins for just their metal value when those coins were worth millions and they sold them for thousands.
Well, I don't know that the central banks were owning gold coins. That's highly unlikely. They would own...
The Canadian government owned them.
I don't know. But they mainly, in their gold reserves, it's in bars.
Yes, if you visit the Winnipeg Mint, they say you can take home that gold bar worth a couple of million dollars if you can pick it up. but they have it beveled side down so you can't get your hands on it. Bob, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on?
Well, yeah, everybody's talking about gold. A little overbought now in the sector. It's had a good run. But we're in a multi-year bull market for gold, so our stance on the golds is to buy the dips rather than sell the rallies. You might end up out of position on an early stages of a lengthy bull market. There'll be, and this is also not based upon the U.S. dollar going down. This is based upon our unique work on the real price, which reflects the earnings in gold mining. So for example, the cost of crude oil over the last 6 months or so has dropped more than 50% against the bullion price. So in just plain gold mining, about 60% of the costs of mining are energy related. Now, one may have a hydro set up or something like that, but nonetheless, you got to use energy for blasting and for the big trucks and stuff like that. And that all comes down to crude oil. So just crude oil falling relative to the price of gold should be improving the earnings of the gold miners. And this is where it's different, because for decades, the gold bugs have pushed the story that you got to buy gold stocks because the U.S. dollar is going to go down. And that is speculating in the foreign exchange markets. Whereas our way of looking at gold's real price and relative to commodities or relative to crude oil is that the earnings go up. So then when you're buying a stock with increasing earnings stream, you're then an investor rather than speculating in foreign exchange. And I think at some point, all of the gold bugs out there will eventually figure it out, but it'll be after the fact. But I kind of like to stay in our continued analysis of gold's price relative to the CRB, general costs, and then also relative to crude oil prices, which is a specific energy cost. And I'm sure that the profit operating margins for gold mining are improving.
Bob, thank you.
It's an investing sector.
Bob, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Jim, good to be with you, and look forward to next week.
My guest has been market historian Bob Hoy. He's the chief investment strategist for chartsandmarkets.com. He was speaking to us from Vancouver. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Robert Campbell, and Bob Hoy. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Now stand by for our company showcase update from Recycloco CEO Zarko Masalgia. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. I'm speaking with Zarko Masalgia, Chief Executive Officer of Recycloco. Welcome back to Company Showcase.
Thanks, Jim.
Zarko, what's the latest at Recycloco?
Well, you know, a lot's been going on, but I think this podcast will be a little shorter this week. But I want to let all the listeners know of the positive progress in the industry and our technology development. First, kind of starting off with the demonstration plant. You know, we are utilizing the demonstration plant with the production of high-purity lithium being produced right now, which we'll also be sending out to different collaborators for their analysis. In addition, we have a lot more battery waste feedstock, such as black mass, that we've been receiving that we'll be feeding through the demonstration plant to produce our other high-value products, those being, you know, the cathode precursor and other lithium products. In terms of more of our direct marketing approach, our team has been pretty active in getting out there more with these direct marketing efforts, you know, having these discussions and just giving a new perspective on battery recycling. And, you know, we've really been experiencing a lot more thoughtful conversations doing it this way, you know, because sometimes it can be really difficult to convey the whole message in short form or text. But I personally noticed the light switch kind of turn on after having these discussions, you know, of our business model and our technology and really how we've all thought this through since we started it and invented, and then the technology was invented in 2016, right? So we really had a good look at the industry and how something like this will succeed in the long run. And we've talked to all sorts of groups, such as technical, finance, and strategy backgrounds. You know, I think it's, and you notice that, right? Because I think it's one thing to see the quick marketing pitch and another to really sit down and analyze the granular details of different markets, technologies, the logistics, and like the pricing of these materials. But, you know, this helps us definitely paint a more practical picture. And, you know, I believe, you know, as this marketing hype starts to settle, in battery recycling, we're going to see a lot more of the works in other business models and technologies when compared to the reality of what the market is actually doing. You know, I see companies building out large plants, meanwhile battery waste feedstock, supply and products are changing a lot faster, and some of these technologies can be developed, and you know, some may be left behind, or some, you know, may not have enough feedstock to run some of these very large plants. And those are also some very important things to consider. And, you know, we've been really watching this, developing, working with a lot of, you know, leading groups in, the technical due diligence of our process. And just kind of really working as that diamond in the rough. But yeah, I think that's, you know, that's definitely an important thing to consider and just really, really look past the kind of nuances of how recycling is being defined and think about and calculate value of materials and, you know, the premium from precursor that you can get versus the metal salts that you produce, like nickel sulfate or cobalt sulfate, right? There's big differences there. And then also kind of, you know, take note of lithium recoveries, right? I think, you know, we're the leaders in lithium recovery from battery recycling. And I don't see much of that being, mentioned in a lot of different, technologies. You know, it's called a lithium ion battery, but we don't see much of the lithium being, recovered from some of these processes. And then that's going to be very important because, you know, on the, you know, in the industry, especially in the EU, and I think these mandates are going to be spreading, you know, worldwide, but you're seeing the EU mandates and their targets becoming a lot more ambitious, right? They just announced some new targets for recycled lithium, nickel, and cobalt contained in lithium ion batteries that will be sold in the EU. Which is going to be a huge market and already is. And it's first going to start with 6% lithium and nickel and 16% cobalt in 2031 that needs to be recycled or, maybe I should word that in a different way. Out of the 6% lithium and nickel and 16% cobalt will need to be the recycled content of new lithium ion batteries. And then that number is going to go up by in 2036, where the recycled content of new lithium ion batteries is going to need to be 12% lithium, 15% nickel, and 26% cobalt. And this is, you know, when companies start planning for this, that's also, you know, making them take more notice of what are they doing within their own supply chain? How are they going to end up getting this recycled material? How much is this recycled material going to cost them? And that's where we believe, you know, being able to take their own waste, recycle it in-house, and then, you know, take the precursor materials and the lithium materials we make and blend that to the, you know, the mandated percentages to make new lithium ion battery cells. So I think those are some very important considerations. And yeah, I really have to look at all of these details to formulate kind of that long-term strategy and what's going to be successful. But, yeah, that's really all I had for this week, Jim. But, like always, like every week, you know, things are looking up and, I'm really confident in the direction we're headed.
Can you tell us where you're traded and where people can get more information about Recycle-Co?
Yeah, we're traded on the TSXV, under the ticker symbol AMY, on the OTCQB under AMYZF, and on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange under ID4. And you can find all the information on our website under www.recycleco.com.
Zarko, thank you so much for the update.
Thanks, Jim.
I've been speaking with Zarko Masalgia, Chief Executive Officer of Recycle-Co. I'm Jim Goddard. Our conversation took place on February 3rd.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.